Spring is right around the corner, and with it, all things will be new again. Or will they? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
It's great to be back with you today on this. We're recording on Thursday, and it's a soaky day here today. It is raining like you wouldn't believe, and it's nasty, and tomorrow it's going to be cold. So what do you know?
Welcome to March. Yeah. We didn't even have to wait till the 15th to get all this weather.
Yeah, late winter in Ohio. It's always this. Are we going to go with the old adage, in like a lion, out like a lamb?
Yeah, well, actually, I would say March is coming in at least like some kind, form of wild beast. We've been enjoying spring for the last, week or so. You've been enjoying it a little longer because you were actually in Florida in warm weather for the week before that. Welcome to living in a temperate zone and living in Ohio. You know, one week we have 70 and 80 degree weather. The next week, they're talking about snow again. And actually, in our area, we are supposed to get, after all this rain comes through today, overnight tonight, they're talking about we might have snow accumulation. So, again, it's one of those things that, yes, it's March, and everybody gets happy about March. And you know, and so, winter's over. Well, winter still has at least 20 more days. As we record this on the 1st of March, winter has 20 more days to play with us, and then some, because, well, just because our seasonal markers say that winter is over and spring is here doesn't necessarily mean that God, in his wisdom with the environment, needs to basically follow our man-made calendar.
I was going to say, he doesn't really need our help. He's got it more or less under control, I think. That thing about bringing floods and earthquakes and tornadoes and blah, 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 and good weather as well. We tend to think of the wrathful God that brings us the tornadoes and the thunderstorms and all the bad stuff, the tempests on the sea and all that. But he also brings us beautiful, sunny, breezy days that you just sit there and go, oh my gosh, this must be a little taste of heaven. You go out and the air smells fresh and everything just is sort of bucolic and beautiful and you just want to go outside and sit outside and walk around in the woods and that kind of thing and watch the trees sprout green leaves and all that stuff. Well, God brings those too.
Yes, absolutely.
He smiles on us with those as well. So it's not all judgment, folks. Sometimes it's blessing. And people don't like to think in these terms, but curses are blessings in some cases. God taking you by the collar and giving you a nice slap in the face and saying, snap out of it, bud, is also a blessing as well as a curse in many cases.
Absolutely. In many cases. That's absolutely true. And, you know, we always look to spring because right around the corner in the next month is, you know, when we celebrate resurrection, Easter, whatever, which way you want to describe it. And so there's always this hope of renewal and rebirth. And you know, everybody talks about when the grass starts greening back up from its winter brown and the flowers start popping up. And I, of course, Facebook has this thing where they share your memories, which means they're tracking you all the time.
Yes.
And so they popped this picture up that I took like 7 years ago on this date, which was yesterday, on the end of February, of a little crocus popping out of the ground, you know, it's a little flower. And so, you know, it got me to thinking about that whole thing. It's like, you know, yeah, we've had times when we've had really interesting weather. I mean, this year has been very interesting because we had a major bunch of rain and then some snow build up, but then that went away fairly quickly. It got really warm, and now it's possibly going back and getting into what we consider to be moderate March weather, with, you know, highs being in the 40s and 50s instead of in the 70s and 80s. And so, you know, we just have to basically stop and say, God is in control of all these things, and we just have to understand that he is living and active in everything, including these cycles, because obviously it's not necessarily a function of global warming, global cooling, whichever way you want to play on that spectrum. It's more of a function of God has built into the base coding of everything in the universe this idea of rebirth and renewal. As a matter of fact, that's the reason why man longs for fulfillment.
Yes.
Because of sin, the original sin of our forebears, Adam and Eve, in the garden, we were separated from that communion with God directly. I mean, he walked with them in the garden, as it says in the scripture. So there was this direct communion with our Creator that was lost because of our sin, because of the sin of Adam, which is imputed unto his descendants, all of them. So that became part of our DNA. But part of our DNA spiritually is that we were made in the image and likeness of God by his hands, and life was breathed into us by his breath. And there is this whole idea of fulfillment or rebirth that we look to. Those of us who understand these things or are given understanding by the Spirit look to these things. Everyone else just looks to, it's warm today, that's great. Oh, it's cold day tomorrow. Oh, that's horrible. I hate life. Let's go on. Because they're dissatisfied, but they don't know what it is that fills up that hole in their lives and in their outlook. But we know, and Scripture's clear of it, that that's a hole that can only be filled by the presence and active influence of the Holy Spirit of God working to change our hearts and bring us back into communion with our Creator. And so that's my sermon for this week.
Well, look, this is a Christian-based program on a Christian-based radio station and a Christian-based blog site. So, yeah, we're allowed to do that. And you know what? Unapologetically.
That's right. You know, I'm not posting it on Facebook, so therefore I can't get it. I can't be banned or shut down. And I didn't tweet it, so Twitter isn't going to like scrub all of my tweets.
Well,
because of it.
when are Christians? Now I understand that Christians unfortunately have the reputation for being reactive rather than proactive. But you know what? It's time for Christians to have. And at one time there was an attempt to, YouTube was blocking a lot of Christian based videos at one time several years ago.
Yeah.
And there was an attempt to bypass them called GodTube.
Yeah. For that. I remember GodTube.
Remember GodTube. A lot of people started posting on GodTube because there was no, anti-Christian firewall there. In YouTube land, what they do now is they just demonetize you and stop telling people you've posted a new video. Well, you can do that yourself. You can do a lot of that yourself through email and that kind of thing. And demonetizing, well, if like the stuff I have up, I never monetized it. So, oh, you're going to demonetize me? Boo-hoo. I wasn't getting a nickel anyway. I've got a bunch of Camp American stuff up there, and I think I'm going to post a whole bunch more. And I'm sure I will be suffer the same fate as guys like, well, Alex Jones, but not just Alex Jones. There's a lot of other people. I don't have much use for Alex Jones, but there's a lot of decent people who are out there. And some people I agree with, some people I don't agree with theologically or socially and that kind of thing. But I do believe in their right to express themselves. Now, some of them are trying to monetize their videos. They're trying to make money at it. I think that's a mistake. I'll be quite honest. Now, I know that you make your money politically lobbying, not politically necessarily, but you're doing a lot of lobbying for social awareness organizations. You're doing lobbying in favor of a lot of pro-life groups, a lot of education reform groups, a lot of that kind of thing. You do lobbying for me for keeping an eye on things that are going on at the State House for medical freedom issues.
Yes.
So I know you do a lot of that kind of thing. Lobbying is not a bad thing, but there are a lot of people out there like me who are doing activism, and we can question how active I've been in the last 2 years, but who are doing activism on a part-time, non-pay basis. When I'm out there speaking to the state legislature about this or that, or if I'm doing a presentation at a Tea Party group, and yes, folks, I am available for presentations on things like the Electoral College, the importance of the Electoral College. I'm available for talking on what's wrong with calling a constitutional convention. If you think an Article 5 convention is a great idea, let me come talk to your Tea Party or other group. I will present evidence that it's a really bad idea. And yes, I will fly in the face of people like Jim DeMint, who's out there saying, don't worry, it'll be limited. No, it won't be.
Anytime a politician or a former politician says the words, don't worry, yes. What is the first thing I start doing?
Worrying.
Worrying, exactly.
But that being said, yes, I'm worried too. But that being said, all mine is non-pay. I've had people try to pay me. I don't take money. If they want to buy me some gas, fine. That's okay. But I've done that before. But, you know, most of the time they hand me an honorarium check, and I'm like, I sign it back over to them. Because they're doing yeoman's work, and I'm here in support. And I know you get paid for what you do. I mean, but, you know, you don't own another business.
No, this is my business.
You don't have a job in industry someplace or as a tradesman or something. You get paid for doing what you do, and you earn your money. Because I've seen you turn around people who thought they crashed and burned and say, no, you did a really good job. Or we'll look at people's testimony and say, you need to cut this, 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 and this, and this out.
Yeah.
You're very good at that. I always submit mine to you before I give it. What I've learned doing that is I've learned to help other people in that. Somebody will come in and show me what they're going to testify to. It'll be like 5 or 6 pages. I go, well, once you learn how to compress that into a page and a half or at 2 pages at most, you're in good shape.
Exactly.
And now I'll read some of the stuff. We helped a friend of ours who testified on the last con, and I said, cut that part right there in the middle. Leave it out. You essentially negate your argument by putting that in there. You don't negate it, but you give people the excuse they need to reject it. And you begin to recognize those things. But the fact is that there are people out there, most of us out here, when I speak in favor of the right to keep and bear arms, I do it as a layman, not as a professional. When I speak about the right to life, I do it as a layman, not a professional. I'm amazed occasionally at some of the just nonsense that I see out of people who purport themselves to be scientists. I do have special knowledge in this area. I do have a degree in biochemistry. I have studied embryology. So, yes, I do have a leg up on guys like, for instance, Bill Nye. When Bill Nye came out to say that I believe a zygote has the same rights as a human or even that it is human, you are just simply wrong. And I'm like, well, Bill, it is you who is simply wrong. Because once...
Okay, well, let's back up with that, because just saying somebody is simply wrong is a form of logical fallacy.
It is. It is. It is a logical fallacy. It's a special pleading. Listen to me. I'm the expert. Well, Bill Nye... I've heard a lot of people, and I always rankle at this. They say, hey, Bill Nye, the science guy. And people say, he's not a scientist, he's an engineer. And I go, well, okay. Having been interested in engineering in the past, I can tell you that engineering is science. It's applied science. In other words, Bill Nye would probably be very good at calculating the stresses on the framing of a building. He would know exactly how to do it. He would apply the science he learned in college. Apply his master's or PhD or whatever he has. I don't know what degree he has. But you always see him in there. He wants to talk about climate science. Well, he's no more qualified to talk about climate science from an expert position than I am. I can talk about it from a layman's position based on the science that I have learned. And Bill Nye can do the same thing. But I had to laugh the other day. I saw Netflix was running a show called Bill Nye Saves the World. And I said, what, does he jump off a cliff? You know, Bill Nye, when he came out and made that statement about zygotes, I'm like, okay, Bill does not understand the mechanics of reproduction, because a zygote is a fertilized egg.
Yes.
Before implantation, after implantation, it's called a fetus. We're talking semantic differences here. Now, does every zygote implant? Well, no, it doesn't. Well, does that mean that God became the cosmic murderer? No, God has lots of reasons for not allowing a zygote to go to completion. Sometimes they're damaged. Sometimes it's something. Yeah, a lot of times women are pregnant and don't even know it because the zygote has not implanted and never does implant. So was she ever pregnant? Well, yes, she was. She had a fertilized egg within her reproductive system. Does she know it necessarily? No. Women, when they say, I can feel that I'm pregnant, that's after implantation, because what they feel is the hormonal changes that happen start happening almost instantaneously after implantation on the cervical wall. Bill Nye was going on the idea that a zygote, well, he doesn't even believe a fetus is a human. the fact is, the question that has to be answered in this case, and that, by the way, that's a logical fallacy too. The question that has to be answered in this case is, how many cells do you have to have before you're human? Because what he's saying is that a zygote is in the one cell state, and it usually doesn't implant until it's further along.
Okay. Well, all right. Let me stop here and let's go through and walk through the logic pattern. Okay. If you are human when you have all of your cells, right? According to Bill Nye. According to Bill Nye. So let me qualify that. You are human when you have all of your cells. Okay. And we know all of those cells, there's cells for making bone, there's cells for your various organ functions, brain cells, et cetera. We know that those cells have specificity, correct?
Yes. Yeah, they're directed. Yeah.
Okay, they're directed cells. That's right. Now, we don't know exactly how many cells are in an adult's brain, or even in a infant's brain. We don't know exactly the number of cells, right?
Okay, well, we have an approximation.
We approximate, but yes.
We don't know for sure.
So when Bill says all of the cells, he has a number in his mind. And that number obviously is greater than one. But I have to challenge Bill's logic pattern, because where did all of those other cells come from? That first cell divided, and then divided again, and then divided again, and then divided again, and divided until you had this massive clump of cells, which then, through the process that God has created for bringing new life into the world, break apart, and in determinate fashion, and I don't mean break apart, but in determinate fashion, they're triggered in order to start specificity of forming all of the various unique things that are in the human body.
Oh, gosh. After the 8 cell stage is when you start getting specialized structures.
After 8, and that's like, what, within an hour maybe after the first cell?
It's pretty quick. It's been a long time since embryology, but yeah, it's pretty fast after that. It takes a little while for it to get down and implant, but they normally implant. Oh, gosh, I forget how many cell stage the implantation is. It's between 8 and, I think it's around the time it turns into a blastocele, which is, okay, the replication takes place. After the 8 cell stage, it starts to form a hollow ball. The zygote fetus starts to form a hollow ball. And the hollow ball turns into itself. Okay.
Yes.
And once that's called a blastocele, and once that happens, then the cells start differentiating on what they will eventually become. This is why the argument over stem cells is so important, because guess what? Those are stem cells. This is why the ghouls in the abortion and also in the research industry were so interested in getting hold of aborted fetuses, because they're chock full of these stem cells that are plenipotentiary. In other words, they can become anything. This was the big yank. This is why people were starting to talk about ethically, quote unquote, growing human embryos that were, you know, the snowflake babies, the frozen embryos, yes, and that kind of thing, taking those over and growing them in a petri dish so we could harvest their stem cells for use in research and disease treatment. I mean, honestly, this is the kind of ghoulish thought pattern you get into when you adopt the thinking of Bill Nye the science guy, Bill Nye the engineer guy. Now, very interesting scientific discussion. I know a lot of our listeners just went, what are these guys talking about? No, what we're talking about is human beings and their development. The fact is that blastocell is much as a human being as you and I are. Otherwise, if you require a certain amount of brain activity and that kind of thing, then where do you draw the line? Are people who have IQs under 60 human beings?
Well, okay, if you're Bill Nye, then if they have lower IQs, does that mean that they're missing some cells, and then therefore we can say they're not human?
Now, here's the bad part, Barry. Okay, the human body, there are papers that have attempted to estimate the number. cells in the human body. The estimates I'm seeing are somewhere in the vicinity of 37.2 trillion.
Okay.
Plus or minus about 0.8 trillion.
Okay. Well, I can go with that because, frankly, that sounds reasonable.
Now, I'm a slightly above average height and probably slightly above average weight. I have a feeling I have a few more cells than that. I think this is on average. Now, someone who is, for instance, suffers from dwarfism or something like that probably has a few fewer cells. Okay, if you're going to apply the criteria, does that mean that the person that is not by any choice of his own or her own is a small person? Are they less human than I am? Is, for instance, some 7'5" basketball player more human than I am because he's foot and 5 inches taller than I am? Are you less human than I am because I'm taller than you are?
Yes, I am less human than you are because you're taller than I am. That's just all there is to it. You know?
Okay.
As Randy Newman says, short people got no reason.
No reason
so.
To live. Yeah, that's right. What a great little song. Randy Newman, I don't always agree with his politics, but he really has a way of showing prejudice. That song is a great song for showing this kind of prejudice.
Yeah.
That's exactly, I mean, I'm sure Newman would not apply it in this case.
But in this day and age of everybody being triggered by every little thing, I don't think you'll ever hear a radio station play that again.
Yeah. I've heard radio stations say, yeah, why do we play this? Because it's a satire.
It is a satire. But honestly, Chuck, let's be honest.
We have lost the ability to recognize. Yeah, we've lost the ability to recognize.
I think by and large in this culture, we've almost completely eliminated the idea of satire and because everyone takes everything so hyper seriously. We have all these debates and discussions over the idea of cultural appropriation. Now, you and I both know what that means. If I were going to appropriate a culture, I'm going to go in and I'm going to take over the culture and I'm going to change everything in their culture to fit what I want. But we've seen this instance a number of times where somebody who is not of a certain ethnic group is effectuating, you know, certain clothing or mannerisms or hairstyles of other cultural groups, and they're attacked for it, mostly verbally, but sometimes physically attacked for appropriating the other person's culture, which, if you stop and look at it, most of the time, the other person who's attacking them is not a native of a certain region of the world where that culture came from, but is just as a member of the American melting pot as anybody else is, and has decided that they don't want to melt anymore. They don't want to be part of the, they don't want to be homogenized. And that's perfectly fine, but you also have to understand that we can't also just balkanize either, which is where I fear we're heading to rapidly in this country over, and again, it's over every little thing. It used to be that you did take a major breakdown over some major issue to create some of those divides. Nowadays, it's, okay, which side of the bed did you get up on this morning? Okay, we're going to go have a massive breakdown in communication and civility amongst people because of somebody looked at somebody a certain way.
Well, yeah.
Okay, I was wrong. This is my second sermon. Okay.
I think we're going to do a lot of those today.
I got the feeling.
We're sort of doing it.
It's almost spring, but it's not there yet.
You know, one of the things you could say is that Europeans did a massive cultural appropriation when they adopted Christianity. Because let's face it, you and I are both Presbyterians, and we both follow the regulative principle.
Yes.
Well, what's the regulative principle? The regulative principle
says that in worship, what is approved or allowed in Scripture is what we do. What Scripture is silent to or disallows, we cannot do.
Well, let me ask you, where does it come from? Where does the regulative principle come from?
Well, it comes from the fact that God is a God of order, and he says that all things are to be done decently and in order. And in his word, he spelled out how we are to approach him in worship.
Okay, but follow my theme here for a minute, and let me ask you a question. Where do we go to look to see what we should adopt as a worship practice under the regulative principle?
We go to the scriptures.
Which ones?
Well, we go to the New Testament and to the Old Testament.
Bingo. We start New Testament is our basic guide, but where do they get it from? They're getting it from the Old Testament. Well, is the Old Testament European? Oh, for that matter, is the New Testament European?
No, really not. I don't even think that you could remotely make a case that there's any European influence of the New or the Old Testament.
Well, perhaps insofar as some of the New Testament scriptures, not all, but some were written in Greek. Some were written in Aramaic, which is not a European language, but Greek is. But the world had been largely Hellenized. That part of the world had been Hellenized for 300 years or better by the time the writing of the scriptures came around. When I say Hellenized, just means that Greek culture had penetrated due to the fact that Alexander the Great conquered that, and his successors split it all up amongst themselves and ruled. Some of them, most of them, adopted very local customs, but there's Greek mixed in. Now, where did Greek not mix in so much? Well, the Jews were very, very, very diligent about maintaining their Old Testament style practices, period. Now, some of them, for instance, if you read your Bible and it says this came out of, sometimes the reference of footnote will say LXX or the Septuagint. Yeah. What was that all about? Well, that was Greeks bringing in Jewish scholars to translate into Greek the Old Testament. When you hear the Septuagint, or the Septuagint, however you want to pronounce it, or see LXX, that means the 70 in Roman numerals.
So when I say it's all Greek to me, that's what
Greek
I mean.
To you, yes. What that means is that is a translation by Jewish scholars who were also bilingual and spoke Greek, and translated the Jewish scriptures into Greek for use by the Greeks for their libraries, so they could do research. I believe that's why you'll hear things about the Alexandrian text and that kind of thing. I believe the Septuagint was written in Alexandria for the Library of Alexandria.
Uh-huh.
And you'll hear Jesus, if you go through the Old Testament or the New Testament and read the quotations of Jesus, in a lot of cases he's quoting almost exactly the Septuagint language.
Mm-hmm.
As put together by the writers who were writing quotes from their, essentially, and now guys like Peter, I don't think Peter ever was able to write, but he had an amanuensis, a secretary, who wrote things. If I remember right, Mark was one of his amanuensis.
Okay.
So, that being said, did Europeans culturally appropriate
Christianity?
You bet they did. You bet they did. Was that a bad thing? No. Look what it has done for the world. Are they abandoning that adoption of Christianity? Yeah, in many places they are, but there are other places that were under the boot of totalitarians for decades in Central Europe who are readopting it. And there's a lot of work to be done there to make sure it doesn't veer off into bad things as it's adopted. I'm always taken aback by people who by Christians who are anti-Semitic, insofar as, do you not understand where your entire do we understand that Jews are among the saved? Well, I don't think so. But they can be if they convert, and Jews are just as capable of converting to Christianity and maintaining a lot of their Jewish practices, because let's face it, the early church kept a lot of the Jewish practices. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about cultural appropriation. Did they evolve apart? Yeah, they did. We don't do sacrifices anymore, and neither did the early Christians. They didn't do sacrifices anymore. Why? Because Jesus was the sacrifice.
That's true. Once for all. That's right.
Yeah, once for all. They understood that.
Yeah, that's the reason why we don't line up bulls and goats and doves and things and come in and, you know, turn the sanctuary or the altar into a bloody mess.
Well, that's what I hear people saying, that we've got to get the temple built so we can allow the Jews to restart the sacrifice. And I'm like, do you think God is going to allow the sacrifice to restart? I don't think so.
Well, that would be a complete repudiation
of
Christ and his work. And I don't think that that's going to, you know, be happening anytime soon. So, but, you know, when you get right down to it, though, Chuck, I mean, this is the kind of thing. And again, you know, we're in spring and we're heading toward the resurrection, the observance of the resurrection. And that's kind of where all this comes from. So, you know, we have to understand that, you know, God has put all these things in order for a reason. You know, and we talked about, you know, the development of the human body, Chuck, and Bill Nye's completely specious argumentation that he uses. You know, all these things tie together, because we have to understand that all of it is governed by God's law. That there is an active law that acts upon all of it. And we, whether we want to, you know, want to admit it or not, we follow it. You know, we either follow it in obeying it, or we follow it in reaping the consequences of the penalties for disobeying it. You know, so there's no escaping it one way or the other. And for those, you know, and God bless, and I don't want to offend anybody, but for those who basically say, well, God is love, and, you know, it's all about grace, you're right.
Yep.
But you're only right partially, because God is who he says he is, and he's also a God of justice. He's a God of rules. He's a God of law, because without God's laws actively being worked out second by second in our world, we would devolve into complete chaos. I mean, what happens, Chuck, if the inherent idea for renewal and rebirth that is woven into by the Creator into the coding of the, you know, subatomic particles inside the cells of, say, grass and trees? Because we know, you know, trees, the sap runs out, the leaves fall off. What happens if in the spring they don't bud and they don't leave? What happens if the grass doesn't turn from brown to green in the spring?
We'll die, among other things.
Okay, now, and let's unpack it for just a second, folks. It isn't that things won't be pretty. We, human beings, will die, because that's where oxygen is made, and where's carbon dioxide that we breathe out is absorbed and transmitted into oxygen. It doesn't come from the clouds. It doesn't come from outer space. It comes from the fact that green plants go through photosynthesis, where the sunlight hits them, and the things that God has already encoded in their subatomic structure can use carbon dioxide for energy and food, and then release oxygen into our atmosphere in order to keep the oxygen level in our atmosphere at a point where we all can breathe. It's God's law. We got to follow it whether we like it or not, whether we acknowledge God or not, whether we believe him to be true or a fairy tale. He's true. And his laws are active around us, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. Whether we're Bill Nye or not, we have to understand that inherently, intrinsically, we are subjects of our king. We are the creatures of a creator. We are the subjects who carry out the commands of our sovereign. And if we forget that, Chuck, does that mean God just throws up his hands and says, well, hey, I can't deal with these folks, they won't listen to me, and he walks away?
All right, let's talk about a Bible verse for a second.
Oh, please.
I'm going to...
Now there you go, throwing that Bible thing at us again.
And he is before all things, and by him all things consist. That's Colossians 1:17. Mm-hmm. He is before all things, and in him all things consist. That is, hold together.
That's right.
That is a statement of truth right there, folks. I'm gonna run off into a little segue just for a second on something I've been sort of studying of late. I had someone at church tell me recently, and if you're listening out there, person, this is not meant to disparage you in any way. However, this person told me they didn't believe in gravity.
Oh, okay.
And I said, okay, how do we stick to the earth? And this person said, electrostatic attraction. And I said, okay, that theory was debunked over 100 years ago. Well over 100 years ago. All you have to do is give someone a different charge than they currently have, and they should be able to fly. Or they are in danger actually of flying clean off the earth. Well, this puzzled me, this rejection of gravity, and I start thinking about it, and on YouTube something popped up, and I watched it. And guess what it was about? And this was part of the argument, electrostatic attraction, and what was it? Density and buoyancy were the three things that kept us held onto the earth. This is flat earth theory. Now, in this day and age, to talk mm-hmm. about people who believe in a flat earth, you're thinking to yourself, I don't know if this person, by the way, who made this original statement to me believes in that or not. Somehow I doubt it, but it is kind of a Gnostic conspiracy theory, and I'll explain what I mean by that coming right up. But there is a whole group of people, and this is kind of a growing movement that the Earth is flat, that the North Pole is at the center, that it's if you look at a UN map, if you look at the UN flag with the two wheat things, you'll see the projection is North Pole at the center, and then the rest of the world spreads out in a circle around that center.
Okay.
What they're claiming is that's exactly what the Earth looks like. And people will say, okay, what about Antarctica? Well, okay, Antarctica, now get this. This is the conspiracy theory. Joe Blow is not allowed to go to Antarctica because it actually is the barrier around the edge of the world to keep you from going over. And that if you can get past Antarctica, there are actually other worlds beyond Antarctica, that other lands that we can't get to, because Antarctica has bordered us off, and the government has made it impossible for us to go to Antarctica to discover these things for ourselves. If you look at the map, Antarctica goes all the way around the whole periphery of the bottom of the world, if you will, on this flat. The whole outside is Antarctica. Yeah. All right. Okay. Why do I bring this up? Okay. Why is it Gnostic? Well, you have to come to a specialized knowledge that is actually a revelation to you to understand why we live on a flat earth. Otherwise, you'll be hoodwinked by the NASA conspiracy to convince us that we live on a sphere. when things are supposedly disappearing below the horizon, they're actually just passing beyond the vanishing point of our vision. This is one of the arguments.
Okay, yeah.
And the sun and the moon are actually much, much, much closer, and the sun is sort of like a big heat lamp.
Chuck, I'm going to stop you right here. We're going to have to figure out, how do people manage to get themselves so balled up in these kind of ever-expanding theories?
Okay.
How do you start down this path?
Amateur psychoanalysis is that somebody wants to be part of a special group. And if you actually, the proponents of this are actually kind of arrogant. Oh, you still believe in a sphere. Yes, well, they'll talk to you about going up in an airplane and not being able to see the curvature of the earth. Well, I hate to tell them this. I've been up, I've flown across the United States at 40,000 feet, and you can clearly see the curvature of the earth. when I flew over Ohio, I forget where I was flying to, California. Well,
when they explain it, that's just an optical illusion brought on by the moisture level in the clouds. I'm riffing here because I'm sitting here amazed that people actually buy this stuff.
When pictures are taken from space, they're photoshopped by NASA. Or they're taken with a camera in which there's an optical illusion caused by the curvature of the lens to make the surface appear curved.
Okay.
Now, go out to YouTube and just do Flat Earth. You'll see debunkers, and you'll see... Now, what's interesting is that the debunkers are just as bad as the Flat Earthers. In that, I wanted to bring this up because I watched a video... Why this is important. I watched a video of how the universe created itself. Okay? That's an argument inside physics right now, that the universe created itself ex nihilo, from nothing, by itself.
Okay. Well, you know what? They're 3/5 of the way there, Chuck. We just have to keep encouraging them until they get all the way there.
Now, yeah, I was going to say.
They've got it partially right.
here's how the argument goes. Now, I had to watch it, and there was a lot of mumbo-jumbo, so you kind of have to use your fallacy detector to cut through the mumbo-jumbo. But they'll do this demonstration of a cylindrical universe. And you're going around in a circle, and when you're at the current and you go back around this cylinder, you're back at the past. But the past is the present. This is why, for instance, I've always asked this question. If laws of nature are uniform and the laws of physics are uniform, and you're telling me that when I look at a quasar, I'm looking at the beginning of some of the explosions that are at the beginning of the universe itself, I'm like, okay, there's a problem with that way of thinking, and that is, at what point did we fly faster than the speed of light? Because in order to do that, to look back at your past, at some point you have to be going faster than the speed of light. It's for the light to reach you later. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand exactly what you're saying, and you know, theoretical physics and all, but I'm still trying to wrap my head around how somebody would fall for this in this day and age.
Well, either end of the spectrum. How could anybody fall for the idea that the Earth is flat? And that's kind of a minor player next to the idea of how can you accept the idea that something created itself from nothing?
Nothing. Yeah.
Now, what you really get down to, once I sifted through the argument, and this thing was like an hour long, so I watched this whole thing and I had to sift the whole time, which requires honestly, a lot of effort, and it makes your brain hurt occasionally because you're sitting there going, huh? And you have to go back and watch things again and say, okay, here's what they were saying. And the bottom line, they don't want to put it in this way, and you'll figure it out when I tell you this, and I'm going to ask you why they put it this way. The universe just is.
because they can't bring themselves to the realization, which is right there in front of them, that God is who he says he is and he exists.
Okay. It's actually a little different than that insofar as they are the universe itself is an uncaused first cause. Now, I'm kind of deep into apologetics at this point.
You're deep, but that's good. Keep going.
Deep is good. It's the universe itself, physical matter and energy, are the uncaused first cause. In other words, they've always been here eternally, and they will always be here eternally. If black holes cause the eventual collapse of the universe. Okay. Mm-hmm. What we're saying is, stop. You can't do that. You can't have something from nothing without an uncaused first cause. And the difference between our uncaused first cause, which is God, this is how atheists try to argue against creation by claiming, everything has to have a cause. That's not what the law of causality says. At some point, there has to be an uncaused first cause. What we're saying is that the universe came into being, and that the physical is not all there is. In other words, matter and energy is not the entirety of existence. We're saying there is an unreachable by us spiritual realm without help from the person who presides in the spiritual realm. In mm-hmm. other words, God created matter and energy for his pleasure. He has no need of it. He can exist in nothing. And nothing existed before he made it. That is our argument. Their argument is that the universe itself is God. That matter and energy are God. Now, they don't want to put it in those terms. Why? Because it becomes clear that in the same way that we exist and believe in God as an article of faith, they believe in the universe as God as an article of faith. It's not philosophy, it is faith. You have to believe that the universe is God and that it had no need of creation. It simply is. This thing about nothing can create itself from nothing.
Like I said, they're three-fifths of the way there. That's it. I mean, all we have to do is just keep
plugging away. Yeah.
Nudging them that direction, and they'll get there. Take a while, but they'll get there.
Okay, apologetically, one of the greatest questions you can ask is, how are you able to make these arguments? By what mechanism in your mind are you able to make these arguments? And when you come down to the bottom line, math, science, everything is based on what?
It's based on the laws of logic.
Logic. Okay. Who wrote the laws of logic?
That'd be God.
And that's the problem you run into. Because if you talk to some of them, they'll say, well...
Oh, no, wait. I'm wrong, Chuck. No, I'm wrong. It was Greek philosophers who came up with logic. Right?
It was Plato, yeah.
Plato.
No. Plato did not write the laws of logic. He simply systematized them. They were already out there. And in fact, when I hear people arguing, people who are involved in the, for instance, the emergent church, who will tell you that the laws of logic didn't exist in the Hebrews thought an entirely different way, I always go back and say, okay, go back to the book of Isaiah. I think it's Isaiah, where he said, God says, come, let us reason together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, how can you reason together if there's no logic? The fact is that Hebrews thought what they call a bipolar way, not mentally, but there's either right or wrong. There's either true or false. They thought in those terms. Don't kid yourself. Just because the Greeks systematized it didn't mean that the Hebrews didn't understand it. In fact, every civilization who has ever existed thought at least to some degree that way. They had to. But otherwise, how would the Egyptians have built the pyramids without true false? I mean, gosh, couldn't you just build it with the point down? And then, you know, build the wide base at the top? Because, I mean, gosh.
Why not?
Yeah, why not? No, that's the whole point. And when you get people, okay, you ask them.
I get it, the point. Yeah. Very good.
No, you get the, you ask people who are giving you these arguments about the universe creating itself and all those things and the laws of logic. You get them down and ask them about the laws of logic. Where'd those come from? Well, they're universal laws. The universe created them. And I go, okay, an inanimate, non-sentient thing, a physical thing, created logic. The ones I've heard is that the one I love is Stephen Hawking proved that the universe created itself through a mathematical formula. I'm like, so what you're saying is that the universe knew that it was under some kind of law when it created itself.
Ah, yes, that's what you would have to be admitting to.
Yes. So, who wrote that law?
But see, there you go. Stop asking questions. You know, you just are supposed to take this on faith.
And that's, okay, folks, that's the essence of kind of deep apologetics.
Yes, it is.
It's presuppositional. I don't reject evidentialism because God gave us evidence for a reason. But you really got to get at it on a presuppositional level. And what do we mean by that? You may have heard that statement said. You don't really understand what it means. I mean, Christians aren't really introduced these days. Well, unless you're at the seminary level, you don't get a systematic presuppositional training. Some of us are born with it. I mean, honestly, I think I was born with one of my daughters was. I mean, she was a presuppositional thinker from the time she was about 4 years old. She would ask questions that got right at the heart of the matter. If this is true and this is true, then why is this true?
Very good.
And I'm like, well, praise the Lord for that.
You weren't a parent like, because it is.
Yeah. No, I would do my best. Sometimes I'd have to go, I don't know.
let me look that up for you. I'll be back.
Yeah, we'll discuss this later. But she's still that way. In fact, all my girls are presuppositional thinkers, naturally. I mean, simply because we tried to inculcate them with that. And our kids were, yes, they were trained at home, folks. I homeschooled. So I have good little.
I can't believe you brainwashed your children like that.
I have good.
Forced them into your belief system. You horrible human beings.
Right back at you, bud.
Exactly. And right back at everybody who casts those stones. Because what are they doing? They're inculcating into their. Again. This is one of those situations where, you know, just like we're talking about science versus faith, the flat earthers versus, the reality of the world, those kind of things. It really all gets down to the fact that we all hold to a set of beliefs that we believe to be true. And we then share them in, you know, training our children. In how we interact with our neighbors and people we meet and our colleagues and our work, etc. That is where we are. We are that way. We will use, and honestly, Chuck, everybody's a presuppositionalist. They just don't acknowledge the fact that they're a presuppositionalist.
That's the bottom line, yeah.
That's the absolute money cord is everyone's a presuppositionalist. But some people presuppose based upon an errant fact pattern and a faulty logic model.
You can have errant presuppositions. In fact, everybody has errant presuppositions, but some are more errant than others. Not everybody has the perfect set of presuppositions. What is a presupposition? Let's just give it to them, since they don't have the training in this. A presupposition are the filters. When you read the newspaper or see something on television or have a conversation with somebody. There are a set of assumptions that you make in your own mind as you filter what they say.
Yes.
In other words, it's not so much a filter in that it keeps garbage out. What it does is it orients it so that you can understand it. So as these bits of information come in, you orient them through your presuppositions. Sometimes you'll find you're talking at cross purposes with people. And sometimes it's a mere semantic difference. You understand a word differently than they do. But then again, that's a presupposition. That's the same thing that we're dealing with people who believe there's a flat earth. They have a false set of presuppositions. The same thing with people who think the universe created itself. They have a false set of presuppositions, and everything goes through that filter. They can do mental and mathematic gymnastics that a lot of people will be impressed with. I found it impressive, but my presuppositions, knowing what I know about God, wouldn't let me believe them. You can do all kinds of mathematical gymnastics. Now, I can't. I never got beyond third-term calculus, so... but I've seen some of these differential equations and some of these equations that are being used, and I'm just in awe. You know, fills two sides of a swinging blackboard. That kind of thing.
Yep.
Well, it's very impressive. It's also quite incorrect. I'm not afraid to tell you that my presupposition says you're all taking that on faith, and you're trying to prove... You're using a mathematical apologetic to prove the correctness of your position, but... Your position is absurd. And for those of you who think it's equally absurd to believe that a spiritual God created everything, okay, fine. But I don't see how something came from nothing.
Yes.
And I don't think it came from nothing.
Wait, something came from nothing without something or someone being behind it.
Exactly.
And Chuck, I know you're aware of this. It's one of these things, and actually I've promised one of my elders at church I'm going to be bringing him this information, but there are some scientists, some thinkers out there, one who is a German scientist by the name of Dr. Werner Gitt, who deals in information theory. Yeah. And honestly, when you start getting into information theory, you start realizing how this all fits together. It starts these somewhat, maybe puzzling things, or people who feel like, you know, oh, you're engaging in circular reasoning. It isn't circular anymore when you go back and say, okay, wait a minute. Everything we're talking about here, everything that's in the universe that is created, has information in it. And we talked about that earlier about how does a dead grass know how to revitalize? You know, how does it know how to change carbon dioxide in the atmosphere into oxygen in the atmosphere, and do so and draw energy and sustenance from it? That's part of the information that's been written into the code, because, you know. Hey, and I get into these, you know, using these phrases because my son does this. Yeah, that's what he does for a living, is coding and writing information for computers. You know, it's the situation that information can only be information if it can be received and decoded on the receiving end, but it has to be encoded and sent from somebody.
From something intelligent,
from an intelligence.
Yes.
Intelligence is not the universe itself, because, you know, that's engaging in the circularity of a circular argument.
Yes, exactly.
The uncaused first cause has to be intelligent.
Yes. It can't be a chaotic blob.
Exactly.
You have to ask yourself. We're out of time, but I'm going to ask the question: What caused the universe to explode from nothing into something? What was the cause? The explosion didn't just happen; something caused it. Okay. That being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. And as we close out, I will tell you that we still have open slots at the Relationships Under Construction banquet, Thursday, March 8th at 6:30 at the Villa Milano. Contact Relationships Under Construction, www.relationshipsunderconstruction.com. That's relationshipsunderconstruction.com. Or you can contact us at principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. And we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.